Mark, how can listeners follow both this case and your work?
Go to liberatedethnicstudies.org.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us on Law and Disorder, and even more so for everything you do every day in this cause. It's important to us, it's important to our listeners, and frankly, to the American people. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Steve and Heidi, and I am so grateful for your support and commitment to educating people about all of this. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll discuss a lawsuit that has special meaning this week that we honor Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
We'll speak with civil rights attorney Flint Taylor about new evidence alleging FBI and NYPD involvement in the assassination of Malcolm X.
We speak with Professor Emeritus from Purdue University, Bill Mullen, on black resistance to fascism. Bill's written two books, We Charge Genocide, American Fascism and the Rule of Law, and The Black Anti-Fascist Tradition, Fighting Back from Anti-Lynching to Abolition. What Bill has to say is profound. We can't rely on anything but ourselves in the streets, demonstrating from day one.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Bogosian.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer. A groundbreaking legal case seeks justice for the family of one of our country's most iconic civil rights leaders, Malcolm X. In an unprecedented lawsuit filed by his daughters, the Shabazz family is challenging the U.S. government, the city of New York, and several high-ranking law enforcement agencies. At the heart of the case is the claim that state actors, including the FBI and NYPD, played an active role in the assassination of Malcolm X on February 22, 1965, and that this involvement has been systematically covered up for decades. This suit, Malcolm X Shabazz et al. Versus USA, not only seeks justice for the wrongful death of Malcolm X, but also aims to hold the government accountable for its complicity in the assassination. The case draws on newly uncovered evidence linking federal agencies to the events surrounding Malcolm X's death, as well as for framing and wrongfully convicting two men who were only recently exonerated in 2021. The legal team behind this case includes civil rights attorneys Benjamin Crump and G. Flint Taylor. If successful, their argument could rewrite the historical narrative surrounding one of our country's tragic and significant moments. At the core of this case is the question, how deep was the state's involvement in silencing Malcolm X? How coordinated was the campaign to prevent the rise of black leaders? And what has been the scope of the government's role in suppressing movements for racial justice and civil rights, both in the past and in the present day? We're joined by attorney Flint Taylor of the People's Law Office in Chicago. Flint represented the family of Fred Hampton and revealed that the FBI and Chicago Police Department murdered him in 1969. Flint is an editor of the Police Misconduct Law Reporter and is the author of Torture Machine, Racism and Police Violence in Chicago. Flint Taylor, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Maria. It's really nice to be with you and Heidi again, and I'm looking forward to discussing this very important topic.
Well, why don't you start by telling us a little more about the lawsuit filed by the Shabazz family? What are its main objectives, and what are the key claims made against the government and law enforcement agencies?
Well, as you know, it's almost 60 years since the assassination of Malcolm X, and a tremendous amount of evidence, so to speak, has come out over the years, but particularly important evidence came out approximately 3 years ago in the case of the two men who were exonerated for being wrongfully convicted for the assassination of Malcolm X. So that gave us the ability and the foundation to bring this case on behalf of Malcolm's sisters and on behalf of his estate. And of course, it is a 1983, a civil rights case brought under the Anti-Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871, and it seeks damages for the family members.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCD Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I'd like Egypt to take people, and I'd like Jordan to take people. You're talking about probably 1.5 million people, and we just clean out that whole thing. It's literally a demolition site right now. Almost everything's demolished.
President Trump calls for more than 1 million Palestinians in Gaza to be moved to neighboring Arab countries like Jordan and Egypt. As tens of thousands of displaced Palestinians return to the north of Gaza, we'll speak to Egyptian-American journalist Sharif Abdelkadous. Then to Trump's crackdown on immigrants and refugees. Colombian President Gustavo Petro at first turned back two U.S. military planes this weekend carrying deported migrants in shackles, saying they should be treated with dignity. Meanwhile, the Pentagon is sending 1,500 active duty troops to the U.S.-Mexico border. This comes as President Trump halts the flights of thousands of refugees already approved to come to the U.S.
We have been living here for 3 years with a hope of going to America or whatever to be safe. But now, just when the President Donald Trump came on the media and told us that, no, we will not process this case or maybe we will delay it, indeed, you will feel like betrayed.
And as the U.S. Senate confirms Pete Hegseth by one vote as defense secretary, we'll look at his extreme embrace of Christian nationalism. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump's facing accusations of supporting ethnic cleansing in Gaza after saying he wants to, quote, clean out the whole thing. Trump made the remark while speaking to reporters aboard Air Force One Saturday.
I'd like Egypt to take people, and I'd like Jordan to take people. You're talking about probably 1.5 million people, and we just clean out that whole thing. It's over the centuries, that's had many, many conflicts, that site. And I don't know, it's something has to happen, but it's literally a demolition site right now. Almost everything's demolished.
Egypt and Jordan have rejected Trump's call. This is Jordan's foreign minister, Ayman Safadi.
Our stance that the two-state solution is the path to achieving peace is firm and unwavering. Our rejection of displacement is also firm and unwavering. This is not only the steadfast and unwavering position of the kingdom, but it is also a necessity for achieving the security, stability, and peace that we all desire.
Hassan Jabarin of the Palestinian human rights group Adala likened Trump's proposal to the, quote, ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people, unquote. Israel's far-right finance minister Bezalel Smotrich called Trump's proposal to clear Gaza of Palestinians a great idea. Smotrich has backed building new illegal Israeli settlements in Gaza. We'll have more on this story after headlines. Tens of thousands of displaced Palestinians are returning to North Gaza today, many for the first time in over a year, as the Israel-Hamas ceasefire enters its second week. But most Palestinians will be returning to find their homes reduced to rubble. The UN estimates 92% of homes in Gaza have been destroyed or damaged during Israel's 15-month bombardment. Hala Shala is a 19-year-old Palestinian heading back to Gaza City.
We experienced tremendous hardship from the moment we left Gaza City. We were displaced from Gaza City's Sujaiya neighborhood. After leaving, we spent 2 nights, one night in Al Dien. Then we moved to Khan Yunis and stayed at Al-Aqsa University. We've been displaced multiple times. When we heard the war had stopped and people could return to Gaza City, we desperately wanted to go back to Gaza City because we missed our home and everyone in Gaza City. Our house was destroyed, but we're fine with living among the rubble.
On Saturday, Hamas released 4 female Israeli soldiers who'd been held hostage since October 7, 2023. Israel then released 200 imprisoned Palestinians, including 70 who are being forced into exile abroad. Hamas has also agreed to release 3 more Israeli hostages by Thursday, including a female civilian named Arbel Yehud. Meanwhile, Israel is being accused of preventing 11 doctors and nurses from the United States from leaving northern Gaza. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces shot dead a 2-year-old Palestinian girl named Leila Mohammed Ayman al-Khatib on Saturday. The girl was eating dinner with her family in their living room when Israeli snipers fired 4 shots into their home near Jenin. One of the bullets hit Leila in the back of the head. Israeli forces have killed at least 16 people in or near Jenin over the past week. In Lebanon, Israeli forces opened fire on people trying to return to their homes in the south of Lebanon. Israeli forces killed at least 24 people and wounded more than 134 people. Israel had been scheduled to withdraw troops from southern Lebanon by Sunday, but the White House has announced a deal has been reached to delay the withdrawal until February 18th. In news from Washington, D.C., Secretary of State Marco Rubio has frozen almost all foreign aid coming from the State Department and USAID. But Rubio's memo exempts military funding to 2 countries, Israel and Egypt. Rubio's memo came as the Trump administration announced the U.S. would resume sending 2,000-pound bombs to Israel, lifting a hold put in place by the Biden administration. The U.S. Senate has confirmed Pete Hegseth as Defense Secretary. Vice President J.D. Vance cast a rare tie-breaking vote to confirm Hegseth, the former Fox News host and combat veteran who faced accusations of rape, spousal abuse, excessive drinking on the job, and financial mismanagement. 3 Republican senators joined Democrats in opposing him. Former Senate leader Mitch McConnell, Lisa Murkowski, and Susan Collins. Ahead of the vote, Democratic Senator Tim Kaine said there were many more qualified people for the post.
There are hundreds of them without the personal baggage of sexual assault claims that have been settled, of allegations of spousal abuse that have been testified to, of allegations of drunkenness on the job and fiscal mismanagement that are the subject of a very extensive report written by non-anonymous co-workers.
We'll look at Pete Hegseth's embrace of extreme Christian nationalism later in the broadcast. The Senate has also confirmed South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem to head the Department of Homeland Security. The final vote, 59-34, with 7 Democrats supporting her. John Fetterman, Maggie Hassan, Tim Kaine, Andy Kim, Gary Peters, Jean Shaheen, and Alyssa Slotkin. On Friday night, President Trump fired a dozen independent inspectors general across federal agencies. The move appears to violate a federal law that requires the president to give Congress 30 days' notice before firing an inspector general confirmed by the Senate. A group of House Democrats wrote a letter to Trump demanding he reverse the purge, saying it's, quote, antithetical to good government and undermines the proper stewardship of taxpayer dollars, unquote. The White House has announced the government of Colombia has agreed to begin accepting flights of deported immigrants after a dramatic standoff between the 2 countries. On Sunday, the Colombian president, Gustavo Petro, turned back 2 U.S. military planes carrying deported people, saying immigrants should be treated with dignity. President Trump then imposed new tariffs and sanctions on Colombia. Petro responded with retaliatory tariffs on U.S. imports, but within hours, the White House announced a deal had been reached. The standoff with Colombia comes as the Trump administration announced nearly 1,000 people were arrested Sunday as federal agencies carried out immigration raids in Chicago and other cities. In Chicago, agents with ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, were assisted by the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, and the U.S. Marshals Service. The Washington Post reports the Trump administration wants every ICE field office to make at least 75 immigration arrests per day as part of a new quota system. Local communities are pushing back. On Friday, school officials in Chicago refused to allow agents into an elementary school. School officials at first thought the agents were from ICE, but they were actually from the U.S. Secret Service. The Justice Department has announced it'll limit enforcement of a 1994 law known as the FACE Act that protects abortion clinics and people seeking abortion care. The Trump administration says it will only prosecute individuals who unlawfully block access to abortion clinics and reproductive health centers in extraordinary circumstances, such as killing someone or causing serious bodily or property harm. Trump also pardoned 23 people convicted under the law. Also on Friday, Trump reinstated and expanded the so-called Mexico City policy, also referred to as the global gag rule, which cuts off U.S. aid to any overseas group that provides abortion services, information, or advocacy. South Korean prosecutors have charged impeached President Yoon Suk-yeol with insurrection after his failed attempt to impose martial law in December, which plunged South Korea into political turmoil. The insurrection charge could lead to a sentence of life imprisonment for Yoon or even the death penalty, though South Korea has not carried out an execution in decades. In the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, M23 rebels say they've seized Goma, the capital of North Kivu province. UN Chief Antonio Guterres called on Rwandan forces to immediately withdraw from the DRC and end its support for M23 fighters, while the Congolese government called Goma's capture a declaration of war by Rwanda. Fighting across the Congo-Rwanda border has also been reported. Some 400,000 people have been forced to flee their homes in eastern Congo since the start of the year, as M23 fighters advance towards Goma, compounding an already disastrous humanitarian situation. Over the weekend, the UN moved to evacuate its staff in the area after 13 UN peacekeeper soldiers were killed fighting the M23. Following an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council Sunday, Congolese Foreign Minister Therese Kayikwamba Wagner called the unfolding situation in her country one of the, quote, darkest periods in recent history, and called for the UN Security Council to sanction Rwanda and impose an embargo on the exploitation of natural resources.
Since January 6, 2025, these illegal forces have intensified their attacks, taking over strategic localities such as Katale, Masisi, displacing millions of civilians and destroying vital infrastructure and committing massive human rights violations. These acts are not only attacks against the people of the Congo, but also against the fundamental principles that govern peaceful coexistence between the nations.
In Sudan, an estimated 70 people were killed by a drone strike on a hospital in North Darfur's besieged city of El Fasher. The World Health Organization says the Saudi Teaching Maternal Hospital, the last functioning hospital in the area, was packed with patients receiving care when the attack occurred. Sudan's government blamed the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, for the massacre. Prior to the assault, RSF had given a 48-hour ultimatum to the Sudanese armed forces to leave El Fasher, warning of escalating attacks. The hospital attack also came a day after two U.S. lawmakers said the United Arab Emirates is continuing to provide arms to the RSF, which the Biden administration recently accused of committing genocide in Sudan. Over 14 million people have been displaced by the war, which started in April 2023. 3 million of those have become refugees, most of them crossing the border to South Sudan and Chad. In news from Germany, the world's richest man, Elon Musk, took a break from advising Donald Trump Saturday to give a surprise virtual address to the far-right AfD party. That's Alternative for Germany. Musk's appearance came just days after he sparked controversy for twice giving a Nazi salute at a Trump inaugural event. Among other things, Musk told attendees it's time to move on from past guilt, an apparent reference to Nazism and the Holocaust.
Well, first of all, I wanted to say that I'm very excited for the IFD. It's good to be proud of German culture, German values, and not to lose that in some sort of multiculturalism that dilutes everything.
The U.S. Air Force says it will continue using an educational video about the Tuskegee Airmen, the first Black Air Force members, and another video about the first women Air Force members after the videos were briefly pulled from the Air Force curriculum, triggering widespread backlash. The reversal comes after the videos were put under review as part of the Trump administration's order to halt all efforts to promote DEI. That's diversity, equity, and inclusion. And Switzerland is facing widespread criticism for arresting and detaining the Palestinian-American journalist Ali Abu Nima of the online publication Electronic Intifada. The UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Opinion and Expression, Irene Khan, called his arrest shocking news. The UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, Francesca Albanese, wrote, quote, "The climate surrounding freedom of speech in Europe is becoming increasingly toxic, and we should all be concerned," she said. Ali Abu Nima was arrested ahead of a speaking event in Zurich. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Tens of thousands of displaced Palestinians are returning home to the north of Gaza for the first time since they were forced to flee their homes at the start of Israel's war on Gaza over a year ago. A river of people that stretched for miles walked north along Gaza's coastal road Monday, carrying what's left of their possessions. Most Palestinians will be returning to find their homes reduced to rubble. The UN estimates 92% of homes in Gaza have been destroyed or damaged over the last 16 months. President Trump's facing accusations of supporting ethnic cleansing in Gaza after saying he wants to, quote, clean out the whole thing. Trump called for Egypt and Jordan to take in Palestinians living in Gaza while speaking to reporters aboard Air Force One Saturday. He told the reporters he'd spoken to King Abdullah of Jordan.
I said to him, I'd love you to take on more, because I'm looking at the whole Gaza Strip right now, and it's a mess. It's a real mess.
So you'd like Jordan to house people from Gaza?
To take people. I'd like Egypt to take people. I'm meeting with, I'm talking to General El-Sisi tomorrow, sometime, I believe. And I'd like Egypt to take people, and I'd like Jordan to take people. I mean, you're talking about probably 1.5 million people. And we just clean out that whole thing. It's, you know, it's over the centuries, it's had many, many conflicts at site. And I don't know, it's something has to happen, but it's literally a demolition site right now. Almost everything's demolished.
Egypt and Jordan have both rejected Trump's suggestion and emphasized a two-state solution ensuring Palestinian statehood is the only way forward. Hamas and displaced Palestinians in Gaza also rejected the idea of being forced out of Gaza. This is Magdi Saddam, a Palestinian waiting to return to northern Gaza.
The call by the U.S. president is completely rejected. Completely. Completely. If he thinks he will forcibly displace the Palestinian people, this is impossible. Impossible. The Palestinian people firmly believe that this land is theirs. This soil is their soil. No matter how much Israel tries to destroy, break, and to show people that it had won, in reality, it did not win. It destroyed and ruined things and showed the people that it is a failed state.
Trump's suggestion that more than 1 million Palestinians should be moved out of Gaza to neighboring Arab states weren't his first controversial comments on Gaza since returning to office. Shortly after his inauguration last week, Trump said he's, quote, not confident the ceasefire will remain in place. He said Gaza appeared to be a, quote, massive demolition site that should be rebuilt.
You know, Gaza's interesting. It's a phenomenal location on the sea. Best weather. You know, everything's good. It's like some beautiful things could be done with it, but it's very interesting. But some fantastic things could be done with Gaza.
For more on reactions to President Trump's calls to, quote, clean out Gaza, we're joined by the Emmy and Polk Award-winning Egyptian-American journalist Sharifa Gokhadous. He works with Drop Site News and spent years reporting from Egypt as well as from Gaza and the West Bank. He was correspondent on Al Jazeera's Fault Lines documentary, The Night Won't End, Biden's War on Gaza, and did a Polk Award-winning documentary on the killing of the Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Sharif, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you here. So these comments of Trump, the last ones echo his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who had said in the last year that Gaza is great beachfront property, talking about it as a kind of real estate deal. Trump, most recently on Air Force One on Saturday night, saying that the more than a million Palestinians should be moved to Egypt and Jordan, that he spoke to the Jordanian king. Meanwhile, Jordan and Egypt talk about their responses, and most importantly, the response of Palestinians.
Well, both Jordan and Egypt have rejected this, and they've done so since the beginning of this genocidal assault. You know, these comments were welcomed by the far-right ministers Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, who said, you know, this would be the voluntary emigration that they've been dreaming about, for Palestinians to be forcibly displaced outside of Gaza and for them to rebuild Jewish settlements in Gaza. I think we have to acknowledge what's happening today, which are these incredible scenes of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Palestinians who have withstood an unprecedented genocidal assault, returning back to the north. We spoke at Dropsite to Mustafa Barghouti just a few days ago, and he said the return of forcibly displaced Palestinians to the north will be the ultimate defeat of Israeli plans, because it means that the goal of ethnic cleansing did not materialize. Let's remember what happened if we go back to October 7th, 2023, when Benjamin Netanyahu took to the airwaves and declared war on Gaza. He said, leave now, to the 2.3 million Palestinians who are living in Gaza. Just a few days later, we saw this shocking directive for all 1.1 million Palestinians who are north of Wadi Gaza to flee to the south. And we saw this unbelievable, unprecedented aerial bombing campaign, and many people forcibly displaced to the south, many of them to Rafah in the beginning. And let's not forget that at the time, Western governments, including the United States government under the Biden administration, were trying to persuade Egypt to take in hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, displace them in northern Sinai, offering economic incentives. There's reporting that shows that this was taking place. Egypt rejected it at the time, but more importantly, Palestinians rejected this. And then we saw them build what's called the Netzarim Corridor, which bisected Gaza. This was a 6 or 7 kilometer wide strip of land. They completely depopulated, forcibly displaced, ethnically cleansed that area, destroyed almost all of the buildings there, set up military bases. And this was essentially, reporting shows in Haaretz, this was called a kill zone. Any man, woman, or child unarmed would enter. It's unclear where the border was of the Netzarim Corridor. They would be shot and killed. And this was essentially the place that divided Gaza. Once you crossed there, you could not go back. We saw in October also a concentrated extermination campaign in the very north of Gaza, in Jabalia refugee camp, in Beit Hanun and Beit Lahia, where they completely did not allow any aid in, and then very systematically started attacking these towns and cities, and forcing people out on essentially what were death marches to the south across the Netzarim corridor and back. And, you know, despite all of this, people withstood, they remained on their land, and now we're seeing these incredible scenes of people returning home. And to think that, Trump can just say they should move to Egypt or Jordan, I think, you know, is preposterous. And we're seeing right now that this is kind of an ultimate defeat of the plans of ethnic cleansing that have dated back to the 1950s for Israel.
So I wanted to go to that quote of Jared Kushner made months ago. That's Trump's son-in-law and former advisor weighing in on Israel's war on Gaza, saying Israel should move Palestinians out of the besieged territory, which he said contains very valuable waterfront property, making the remarks during an event hosted by the Middle East Initiative at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.
And Gaza's waterfront property, it could be very valuable to if people would focus on kind of building up, livelihoods. You think about all the money that's gone into this tunnel network and into all the munitions. If that would have gone into education or innovation, what could have been done? And so I think that it's a little bit of an unfortunate situation there. But I think from Israel's perspective, I would do my best to move the people out and then clean it up. But I don't think that Israel has stated that they don't want the people to move back there afterwards.
So that's pretty amazing comment. Invaluable beachfront property. Earlier today, I was watching the Palestinian attorney Diana Bhutu on Al Jazeera when asked about what Trump said. You know, I think all agree it does look like a demolition zone. There's no question about it. How can Palestinians live there? And she said, okay, if there's that question, rather than moving them to neighboring Arab states like Egypt and Jordan, what about moving them home? She said 80% of the people of Gaza come from places in Israel.
Yeah, I mean, this is why Gaza has long been a site of resistance in historic Palestine and long been a place that Israel wants to ethnically cleanse, because it is the largest concentration of Palestinian refugees in historic Palestine. So there's always been a restive place. These people who, 80% of them or their descendants, want to return to their homes, which are mostly the towns and villages around Gaza. And like you said, this is now, they are returning in these really incredible scenes that we're seeing right now.
I mean, but this is a flood of humanity.
People hugging who haven't seen, they've been separated from their family members, from mothers and fathers, separated from their children for 15 months, and they're reuniting for the first time. They never thought they would see each other again. But they are returning to, as you said, a devastated landscape. Nearly the entire, every house has been destroyed or badly damaged. People, the government authorities are telling people to bring their tents with them. There are not even enough tents for people to set up on the rubble of their homes. And as we've been seeing in other parts as well, while Israel has violated the ceasefire nearly every single day, killing Palestinians, especially in Rafah, the death count, the official death count, has been also shooting up since the 19th, when the ceasefire went into effect, because dozens of bodies are being recovered from under the rubble. And so, you know, I'm afraid we're going to see a lot of this as people search for their loved ones as they're returning to this devastated landscape. But they're determined not to leave their land, and many of them will set up tents on the rubble of their homes.
And then we go to the West Bank and what's happening there. We just spoke to Mariam Barghouti. You wrote a piece with her for Dropsite. If you can talk about the intensification of violence against Palestinians there.
Well, essentially what we saw soon after the ceasefire went into effect, a war on the West Bank, initially dubbed the Iron Wall. All of these things had been taking place already, attacks on Jenin, closures of checkpoints and so forth, but a massive escalation of this, to the likes of which we haven't seen since 2002, an invasion of Jenin. Right now, they are demolishing the refugee camp, not just with bulldozers as we've seen in the past, they are actually detonating, the way they have done in Gaza, parts of this. 2,000 families have already been displaced. Across the West Bank, there was usually around 700 military checkpoints. Now there's close to 1,000. They've all closed down. Cities have been closed off from each other. People can't leave their towns and villages to go to school, to go to work. They're separated from each other. And so this is, they're laying siege to the West Bank. And a lot of what we show in the reporting and what has been said was that this was a trade-off that Netanyahu, trying to convince his ministers like Smotrich and Ben-Gavir to sign on to the Gaza ceasefire plan, that they would launch this kind of unprecedented military assault on the West Bank.
There's so much to talk about, but I wanted to go back to Egypt. While they're saying no to Egyptians being displaced into, while they're saying no to Palestinians being displaced into Egypt, the Egyptian government has renewed its judicial harassment of Hossam Bakhat, according to Human Rights Watch and other groups. Hossam Bakhat, one of Egypt's leading human rights advocates, executive director of the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights, also worked as an investigative journalist for the independent media outlet Madamasser. Earlier this month, the Supreme State Security Prosecution charged Bakhat with, quote, involvement with and financing a terrorist group and spreading false news. He was then released on bail, the charges following the release of a report by Bakhat's group about dire detention conditions in a prison in Egypt. Now, we've interviewed Hossam Bakhat many times on Democracy Now. We saw him in Sharm el-Sheikh at the UN Climate Summit. You were there too, Sharif. He was a person everyone rallied around, even as they talked about the freeing of Alaa Abdel Fattah. Let's talk first about Hossam, then finally about Alaa.
Well, Hossam Bakhet is one of Egypt's leading human rights advocates and was banned from travel for 8 years. We had him on Democracy Now! Just last year. He was allowed to travel for the first time in 8 years as a result of a long-standing case targeting NGOs in Egypt. And he had asset freezes as well on his bank accounts. And, yeah, we just saw a few days ago that he was dragged into state security prosecution, interrogated for 6 hours, mostly focused on a report that his group, the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights, put out about the conditions in prisons, a particular prison, where prisoners have started a hunger strike on January 4th to protest things like lack of exercise. They're kept in their cells for 23 hours a day, reductions in the amount of food they're getting, in how long visitations are. And so because EIPR put out this report, Hossam was then hauled in and, accused on charges of terrorism and broadcasting false news. And Hossam has also been very outspoken in the case of Alaa Abdel Fattah, who is Egypt's most prominent political prisoner. He's been in prison near constantly since 2013. His last imprisonment was a 5-year sentence where he was sentenced for sharing a Facebook post about torture in prison. That sentence should have ended on September 29th. And the Egyptian government did not recognize 2 years of pretrial detention as part of his sentence, which is in violation of Egypt's own penal code. And so his mother, Leila Swaif, started a hunger strike to protest each day he's kept past that sentence. She's now on day 120 of her hunger strike. I spoke with the family.
It's almost impossible to fathom.
Yes, and she has British citizenship, so does Alaa. And so they've been pressuring the British government to try and advocate for Alaa's release. She's been going outside of the Foreign Office every day in London. Spoke with the family the other day. Her collapse is imminent. She's probably going to be hospitalized soon. She's refusing to eat until her son is released. And the British government, sadly, David Lammy, the foreign secretary, visited Egypt and repeated the same kind of statements that we've seen over and over again, said they called for Alaa's release, but no pressure whatsoever brought to bear on what is essentially an important trading partner.
He could have demanded to meet with one of his
subjects. He has not had
consular
access to British officials, to the British embassy, for over 3 years now. And he could have, they have huge economic trade deals with Egypt, the UK, very strong diplomatic ties, and yet they just allow Egypt to refuse to release Alaa. And they say we've tried to call for it, but nothing is happening. And meanwhile, his mother now is at very real risk of being hospitalized, and hopefully nothing worse than that. I don't know.
Well, Sharif, I want to thank you for being with us. People can go to democracynow.org to see our interview just a few days ago with Peter Gresty, who was imprisoned with Alaa. Can see our interviews with Leila Swaif, the mathematics professor, University of Cairo, who is on a hunger fast right now for her son. And the interviews we did with and Sharif did with Alaa over the years. Sharif Abdelkaddous is an award-winning journalist and editor at Drop Site News. He was a correspondent on the Fault Lines documentary The Night Won't End on Al Jazeera English. Coming up, we look at the developments in Trump's crackdown on immigrants and refugees. Back in 20 seconds. Americano. I am Mexican-American by Los Sensoles. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to President Trump's crackdown on immigration. The White House says Colombia has agreed to begin accepting flights of deported migrants to land in Colombia after a dramatic standoff between the U.S. and Colombia unfolded on Sunday, with the Colombian President Gustavo Petro turning back 2 U.S. military planes that were carrying deported migrants in shackles, saying immigrants should be treated with dignity. President Trump then imposed new tariffs and sanctions on Colombia, 25% tariffs that he said would go up to 50%. Petro responded with retaliatory tariffs on U.S. imports, but within hours, the White House announced a deal had been reached. The standoff with Colombia comes as the Trump administration announces nearly 1,000 people were arrested Sunday as federal agencies carried out immigration raids in Chicago, in Newark, and in other cities. Local communities are pushing back. This comes as the Pentagon sending 1,500 active-duty troops to the U.S.-Mexico border, including 500 Marines, where they'll join thousands of National Guard and Reserve forces already deployed there. For more, we're going to Mexico City, where we're joined by Fernando Garcia, founder and executive director of the El Paso, Texas-based Border Network for Human Rights. Fernando, welcome back to Democracy Now! There are so many developments around migration. Talk about the increased militarization on the border for beginning.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me again. Well, we see it again. I mean, this is not the first time that we had seen the deployment of the military, the U.S. military to the border specifically. We had seen it multiple times, but this time it seems that it's a little bit different. And however, we're very, very concerned. We don't know what is going to be the scale and the magnitude of the deployment. As you mentioned, we have at least now 1,500 active duty soldiers being deployed specifically in El Paso, where they're going to be trained at the Fort Bliss military base. Then maybe they're going to be deployed in other parts of the border. But it's very problematic in many ways. As you know, we had incidents in the past where the military has been deployed and they had engaged with civilians, both in the Mexican side of the border, but also in the U.S. side of the border. We had the incidents in 1997 in Redford, Texas, where the Joint Task Force 6 Marine unit killed a U.S. citizen, Ezequiel Hernandez. So that is part of the context what we're seeing right now in this deployment under the Trump administration. Mm.
And you're in Mexico City. We usually talk to you in El Paso. Mexico refused to accept a U.S. deportation flight like Colombia. But then the White House press secretary, Trump's press secretary, tweeted that they then accepted 4 deportation flights. Can you talk about what's happening in Mexico right now and President Trump's re-establishing the Remain in Mexico edict for migrants trying to cross into the United States?
You know, listen, it is quite unclear what Mexico specifically is going to do. What we know is what the Trump administration is doing. They're trying to implement 2 different processes towards Mexico. The first one is these return flights that we don't know if these are only Mexicans. Obviously, Mexico had said in the past that they're just going to accept Mexican nationals coming back or being returned and deported. But also the other part of the program is what is called the Remain in Mexico. That means even other nationalities, not only Mexicans, would be sent back to border cities such as Ciudad Juarez, close to El Paso, or Tijuana in California. So that is the 2 different programs that are actually being implemented in Mexico. Mexico had said it many times already that they are only going to accept Mexican nationals and they are not necessarily going to accept the deportation to Mexico of other nationalities. However, that is to be seen. As you have seen already, the United States is putting a lot of pressure in terms of economic terms, tariffs on Colombia and Mexico to accept these new programs that actually failed dramatically in the first administration of Trump, where we have refugee camps along the U.S.-Mexico border with no essential services, no legal support, no food, no water for many of the people that is being deported to those border cities.
Before we go, Fernando, there is a lot of reporting on the shock of migrants across the United States and the terrible fear communities are facing. But there's also a lot of pushback and organizing. If you can talk about what's happening with community forums, workshops, Know Your Rights programs from Eagle Pass to areas in El Paso and others, how you're pushing back.
So we just launched what is called the Community Education Program on Constitutional Rights. I mean, this is something that we had been doing for many, many years both at the U.S.-Mexico border, but also in the interior of the United States, where we're teaching people about the rights under the Constitution. And I think this is specifically important today, because the people right now is having anxiety and fear of not only of detention, deportation, but also of family separation. What we are trying to do with this program is to give people the tools to help to deal with situations where they are confronted with law enforcement, especially with immigration raids in their homes, in the streets, in their workplaces. And we're just reminding people, essentially, that the Constitution of the United States still exists, that under the Fourth Amendment, for example, of the Constitution, they only can allow somebody into their property or house or workplace only with a search warrant or the permission of the owner. Or, for example, if they are confronted and being asked questions by law enforcement, that they have the right to remain silent, that is guaranteed by the Fifth Amendment of the United States. Like those key elements, that's what we're trying to actually tell people, educate them, and organize them around that concept of constitutional rights.
Fernando Garcia, we want to thank you for being with us. We're going to be checking back with you frequently. Founder and executive director of the El Paso, Texas-based Border Network for Human Rights, speaking to us today from Mexico City. We look now at the impact of an executive order President Trump signed on his first day in office that paused the U.S. refugee admissions program in order to see if it, quote, aligns with the interests of the U.S. and should be resumed. Trump's order led to the cancellation of flights for thousands of refugees already approved to come to the U.S., including children and families fleeing war, violence and persecution. This comes after some 100,000 refugees were settled in the U.S. last year under the program. The order was condemned by the largest refugee resettlement agency in the world, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Vice President J.D. Vance, who is a practicing Catholic, responded Sunday on Face the Nation.
And I think that the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops needs to actually look in the mirror a little bit and recognize that when they receive over $100 million to help resettle illegal immigrants, are they worried about humanitarian concerns or are they actually worried about their bottom line?
The Conference of Catholic Bishops clarified in statement, every person resettled through the refugee admissions program is vetted and approved by the U.S. government, and added government funds do not cover the full cost of the services the agency provides. For more, we're going to Baltimore, Maryland, to speak with Krish O'Mara Vinyaraja, president of Global Refuge, formerly known as Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. Global Refuge is one of the agencies that received a stop work order on Friday from the Trump administration. Krish, thanks so much for joining us. If you can explain, who are the thousands of refugees all approved to come here, many fleeing persecution in their own countries, but their flights canceled, and then groups like yours, what this means that you've got a stop work order?
I appreciate that question because I do think there's a lot of confusion and conflation around this issue. And I think people are throwing around the word illegal unfairly. So refugee resettlement is a system through which individuals, families, cross an international border. They apply through the United Nations or the U.S. Embassy. They wait literally years to go through extreme vetting, so CIA, FBI, Department of Homeland Security, Interpol, in order to go through these background checks, health clearances. Only when they have cleared those hurdles are they admitted to the United States. These are the select few, in that 1% of refugees are ever resettled in their lifetime. And that's the reason why this is the gold standard of legal immigration pathways into the U.S. That is why this program has always had bipartisan support. President Reagan resettled 600,000 refugees during his time in office. And so, you know, for us as the second largest network in the country, it is heartbreaking because we have 6,000 families, children, who did everything we asked them to do. They came to the U.S., they are here, and now we fear that they are stranded because in terms of keeping a roof over their heads, making sure that their children have access to public schools, making sure that they have even access to food, it is a public private partnership No one is making money off of this. We work with community groups, churches, in order to support these families. But we fear what the future holds, because even for our Afghan allies who worked alongside our military, we don't know how we're going to help them come today and tomorrow, this week, next month.
So explain for the Afghan allies, I mean, for the people coming from Afghanistan, these were the ones who risked their lives helping U.S. troops, helping saving U.S. soldiers' lives in Afghanistan?
Yeah, so we made a promise to them. We said, look, if you were going to face Taliban retribution, death threats, because you are risking your life, your family's life, by working alongside our military, the U.S. Embassy, to advance our mission, our promise to you is that we will not leave you in harm's way. It is why national security champions are such vocal advocates of the refugee resettlement and the special immigrant visa program, because it's obviously not just the right thing to do to keep our promise to these individuals, but it's a smart thing to do, because the only way we wage a 21st century war is if we have the local support. And so for these Afghan allies, their ability to successfully integrate into our local communities, because they are here, is now in question. And for the allies who we left behind, who the lucky few are able to travel, it's also unclear what happens to them.
So talk about the pushback and how you're organizing. Where are the hubs of refugees who are already living in this country, who groups like yours support, coming from other places?
That's the beauty of this program, is they're not concentrated in one location. They're not in, you know, some democratic city alone. There's a complex algorithm that we work with the State Department. We take into account if they have U.S. family ties. We take into account job market, affordable housing, where there might be a concentration. We work with state refugee coordinators. Candidly, every single concern that was flagged in the executive order is addressed by a program that was designed and fine-tuned over four decades to address those concerns. And so they are in the reddest of red states, the bluest of blue states. Local communities work with us and welcome these families because they know that this is such an incredibly powerful program that just reflects the spirit of American generosity.
So, as you've said, this has gotten bipartisan support for years. What's changed?
I wish I knew. I mean, you know, I expected during the election season that we would have some, you know, hateful rhetoric, that we might hear, you know, kind of misstatements. But I expected that in terms of in governing and executing these programs, that there would be a really close look at those programs that are advancing U.S. interests and those that may not. I hope that it's just a matter of taking the time in the transition period to just have a quick understanding of what these programs are. Secretary Rubio obviously has the experience of having come from the Senate, knowing fully well what refugee resettlement is. And so we are hopeful that as people understand the ramifications of not just the executive order, but the work order, that this will be reversed in short order. But I really, I pray that this program does not get caught up in politics.
And how is Global Refuge, your organization, going to operate now?
So we've done this work for 85 years. Our refugee resettlement program began when Lutheran pastors, professors fled Nazi Germany. And it has always been done successfully in partnership with community organizations. And so that is our plea right now, which is if you're interested in volunteering, if you're interested in helping this cause, go to globalrefuge.org. But we're going to have to be crafty in terms of making sure that these families are supported, in making sure that the U.S. keeps its promise to Afghan allies, and making sure that a program that has been really perfected over four decades, that we don't accidentally dismantle it.
Krish O'Mara, Vinyaraja, we want to thank you for being with us. President of Global Refuge, speaking to us from Baltimore. Next up, as the Senate confirms Pete Hegseth by one vote as defense secretary, we'll look at his embrace of extreme Christian nationalism. Stay with us.
King stages, the kids in cages, we're not the first, we're not the last.
beginning to believe in something. But God is gone and I don't think she's coming back. Came in waves and we were awakened. Though some of us are still attempting. In church, in elementary school, with guns not even foreign souls.
The Plague by Jensen McRae. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with the Senate confirmation of Pete Hegseth as defense secretary by one vote on Friday night, and Hegseth's embrace of extreme Christian nationalism. Vice President J.D. Vance cast a rare tie-breaking vote to confirm the former Fox News host and combat veteran who faced accusations of rape, spousal abuse, repeated public drunkenness, and financial mismanagement of veterans' organizations. Three Republican senators joined Democrats opposing. That's the former Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, and Maine Senator Susan Collins. We go now to Denver, Colorado, where we're joined by Logan Davis, a longtime political consultant and columnist for the Colorado Times Recorder, where his recent piece is headlined, Pete Hegseth and I Know the Same Christian Nationalists. Logan, welcome to Democracy Now! Explain his record and what you mean by extreme Christian nationalism.
Thanks so much for having me. Important thing to understand about Pete Hegseth is that he's been very clear about what he believes and what faith communities he sees himself as being a part of. He's written books. He has appeared on podcasts. In Hegseth's case, he is affiliated with a conservative sect of Calvinists who have been driving the classical Christian education movement for a long time, which he is also associated with, embrace things like sphere sovereignty, and have Yes. So sphere sovereignty is the extreme interpretation of Christian nationalism referenced in The Guardian this most recent week, in which there is an understanding of different authorities being given to the church, the state, the family, etc. And ultimately, the church is above all of those. So Hegseth is a member of a faith community that believes in the supremacy of the church over earthly affairs and has pursued that. And I think there's reason for concern as to which of those beliefs he will bring to the Pentagon.
So if you can talk about, for example, his views of women, whether he's talking about getting women out of combat military, what that means, how that fits into his Christian nationalist beliefs.
So Christian nationalism, of course, has some variety towards it, to it. In Hegseth's case, he's a member of a community that very much is led by a man named Doug Wilson, based out of Moscow, Idaho. Wilson has been a lightning rod for controversy over the last few decades for his positions on things like slavery and the separation of church and state. And in this case, whether or not women should have the right to vote. He has said that that was bad for the family. In this community, there is a certain chauvinism. And I think it is interesting that Hegseth is stepping into this role shortly after we've had conversations about women in combat roles, about greater egalitarianism in the military. I would expect that he's going to see some of that rolled back, and I think that his spiritual leaders and folks like Doug Wilson would be pleased to see that.
So talk more about the glorification of the Confederacy as a godly cause within Reformed Calvinist circles and their views of slavery, particularly what Pete Hegseth has said.
So we know that Hegseth has strongly endorsed Wilson's take on this. Doug Wilson has made the Confederacy a pretty popular trope in Reformed and classical Christian education circles, which has always been interesting to me, given that he is not even a Southerner. Going back several decades, Wilson has really embraced a neo-Confederate strain. Two decades ago, he wrote a pamphlet entitled Southern Slavery as It Was with a guy named Steve Wilkins, who was the head of the League of the South, which is listed by the Southern Poverty Law Center as a hate group. And Wilson and Wilkins toured with this pamphlet, which essentially argued that antebellum slavery in the American South was a beneficent institution that kept families together and helped expose black families to the gospel. So he really argued full-throated that the institution of American slavery was a beneficent American institution. And we know that Hegseth has studied at this man's feet. He talks on virtually every podcast he has been on about the most recent thing he has read from Doug Wilson. He seems to have consumed all of his books. He talks about him on podcasts constantly. Most people in American public life do not have a track record of having defended antebellum American slavery. The fact that the incoming Secretary of Defense firmly sides with a man on the other side of that divide is probably not a great sign.
I wanted to talk about your background and Pete Hegseth's background. The community of the Reform Calvinists, the Hegseth family, and what you were a part of. For example, you grew up in a Reform Calvinist church that was similar to Hegseth's, one of his children attending the high school that Hegseth's child attends.
So I did. I grew up in the Reformed community in and around Nashville, Tennessee. My father is actually a pastor. To his credit and ours, when the Doug Wilson faction, the Communion of Reformed Evangelical Churches, splintered off, we did not go with it. However, a lot of the folks in our school, which was a classical Christian school very much affiliated with our church, did. And that's kind of a whole package, the church and classical school thing. So I do know many of the same people as Hegseth. The classical school that he moved to Nashville to send his children to, it's kind of a bookend to the one that I grew up in. They are on either end of the Nashville area. Several alumni from my school have taught his children. I'm very familiar with the doctrine and the curriculum that they share because I was taught much of it as a child, less so on the doctrine side towards as things got a little bit later. We were never, for instance, on the slavery defending end of things. The curriculum, however, at the classical Christian schools, nearly identical. And I think there's a lot of reason for concern in there as well, because there are, for instance, those tropes about the Confederacy or the Crusades and how those things are portrayed. I think that it's a risky thing to be teaching young children.
And talk about the tattoos on his body, not just artwork, but the political and religious significance that go back to the Crusades, Logan.
Absolutely. The Crusades are a popular historical trope in this community. During the first couple decades of this century, especially, we saw the Crusades kind of resurge in popularity in curriculum and discussion, for the obvious reason that it was being used to impose a kind of clash of civilizations frame on the global war on terror, conflicts in the Middle East, and it was being done in such a way as to cast Christian America as the sword of the Lord in that context. With Hegseth's service and what we know he has said about that, it is pretty clear that his Crusader tattoos are a reference to his service in the war on terror.
So in this last minute we have, if you can respond to him becoming head of this 3 million person organization, the charges against him of spousal abuse, of rape, but they were non-disclosure agreements, non-disparagement agreements, repeatedly of public drunkenness and driving to veterans organizations. Well, I was of financial irregularity in running these two organizations.
This is the thing about Hegseth, right? Is we can talk about his faith, we can talk about his community. The biggest problems with Hegseth, I mean, his beliefs are troubling, but he is wildly unqualified for this role. He also has a long track record of demonstrating a fairly serious moral unfitness to be in polite society. My biggest concern with that is a man holding these fairly intense, far outside of mainstream beliefs, finding himself in a position well beyond anything he is qualified for or has experience in. I think that that puts us in a position where he is likely going to be leaning on these controversial faith leaders in his life more than somebody with adequate experience for the job might. So I think we do need to be concerned about...
Logan, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much, but we'll link to your article in the Colorado Times reporter, Logan Davis. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Gave me a sense of integrity that I wanted to uphold in my own life.
I wanted you to know from someone who's been in recovery more than 30 years now that hard work is what creates success, not alcohol or other drugs. I said it a lot, and I'm glad you took it to heart.
Talk, they hear you. For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
You are listening to 88.3 FM, WRCT, Pittsburgh.
While walking after midnight out in the moonlight, just like we used to do, I'm always walking after midnight searching for you. I walk for miles along the highway. Well, that's just my
you.
promise forever to have and to hold. I can never be free.